Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Stanford Continuing Studies. This winter, join Stanford historians James Sheehan and David Kennedy for the Cold War and its legacies, exploring the global impact of this pivotal era. Learn more at continuingstudies.stanford.edu.
GMT, this is Weekend with Owen Bennett-Jones. And today, Donald Trump may not have got the Nobel Peace Prize, but he did win something else.
Mr. President, and you definitely deserve the first FIFA Peace Prize.
Also in the program today, how Somali Americans are feeling after their president said he doesn't want them in the country.
Deep down, I'm actually scared, because if the president is targeting the community, whether we have legal documents or not, that just shows you that I can never be full American.
We'll be asking why Israel and Lebanon have started talking.
We want to reach an agreement in order to liberate our occupied territories.
And mining for crucial minerals on the ocean floor. All coming up on Weekend.
Hello, I'm Eileen McHugh with the BBC News. Rights groups have criticised the award by football's governing body of a new peace prize to President Trump at the draw for the Men's World Cup in Washington. The head of FIFA, Gianni Infantino, announced the creation of the award last month, shortly after Mr. Trump lost out on the Nobel Peace Prize. Claire Richardson is in Washington.
FIFA's boss Infantino had made very clear that he thought the U.S. president deserved that. But it comes at a moment where rights groups have been sounding the alarm over the fact that this competition is taking place in part in the United States. Concerns over immigration, concerns over a travel ban that affects countries, including Haiti and Iran, who will be competing in this tournament. But the surprises are not over. We'll be seeing plenty of football and also more information coming out on Saturday in terms of where those games will be taking place and when.
The Colombian government has signed an agreement with a major drug trafficking gang aimed at bringing peace in the areas under the group's control and its eventual disarmament. The Clan del Golfo is the biggest armed criminal gang in the country. Here's our America's correspondent, Will Grant.
The Colombian government believes the plan has potential for bringing about a significant improvement in security, particularly in terms of the recruitment of children and minors to the gang's ranks. However, many in Colombia remain sceptical, and critics say earlier peace accords with other armed groups have not been properly implemented and have involved impunity for widespread human rights abuses. There is also the question as to whether an organisation making so much money from global cocaine trafficking is genuine or serious about demobilisation and prepared to step away from the lucrative trade.
Officials in Afghanistan say four civilians have been killed after an exchange of heavy fire with Pakistan's forces along their shared border. Three injuries were reported in Pakistan. Both sides have confirmed they exchanged artillery late on Friday night, but have accused one another of opening fire first. Sporadic fighting has repeatedly broken out between the two countries in recent months. The president of Sri Lanka has announced financial help for people whose houses were destroyed by Cyclone Ditwan last week. Thousands of survivors who lost their homes in floods and landslides will receive over $30,000 to buy land away from high-risk flood zones and build new housing. President Trump has welcomed the recommendation by a panel of advisers that newborns in the US should no longer be vaccinated against the hepatitis B virus. In a social media post, Mr. Trump said he'd signed a memorandum that the American health authorities should review child immunization around the world and adopt best practice. Leading experts had argued that vaccination within 24 hours of birth had prevented more than 90,000 deaths. This is the World News from the BBC. US lawmakers are already expressing concern about Netflix's proposed takeover of Warner Brothers' streaming and studio business. The deal is worth $72 billion, but it still needs to be approved. Critics say it would create a dominant force in entertainment, leaving Americans with higher streaming costs and fewer options. The Writers Guild of America has warned the merger would cut jobs and worsen conditions across the industry. The European Union's law enforcement agency says migrant smugglers are increasingly turning to new technology to find and control their victims. A new report from Europol shows that human traffickers copy the style of social media influencers to teach others how to recruit and manipulate vulnerable people online. Several hospitals in Britain have started a trial of a new technique to treat prostate cancer. Aquablation involves using a robot-assisted high-pressure water jet to remove cancerous tissue. Our health correspondent Dominic Hughes reports.
The main surgical method used to treat a diagnosis of prostate cancer is what's known as a radical prostatectomy, which sees the entire prostate gland removed. But this can leave men facing some distressing side effects, including incontinence and erectile dysfunction. This new technique, aquablation, combines robot technology with very high-pressure water jets to remove cancerous tissue in and around the prostate, but without damaging the nerves and muscles that are associated with bladder control or the ability to get and maintain an erection.
For the first time since the start of the war in Gaza, the Palestinian West Bank city of Bethlehem will publicly celebrate Christmas. Local residents in Bethlehem, considered by Christians to be the birthplace of Jesus, have welcomed the return of the festivities. Bethlehem's mayor said there had been a muted atmosphere and little work for the past 2 years, with the festive season limited to religious ceremonies. BBC News.
It is 7.06 GMT and you're listening to Weekend from the World Service of the BBC with Owen Bennett-Jones. Two guests with me today. As normal, we have people commenting throughout the programme on what we're hearing. And we've got Jacqueline Magnay, Europe correspondent for the Australian newspaper, and Emed Baddy, senior fellow at the Global Initiative Against Transnational Organised Crime. Welcome to you both. We're going to talk football now. So first of all, let's just listen to what's been going on. The 2026 World Cup finals draw took place in Washington yesterday. A snowy backdrop, lots of glitz and glamour. And the event was more than simply pulling names out of a hat to work out which groups the various teams would be in. The football's governing body presented a newly created peace prize to President Trump. The head of FIFA, Gianni Infantino, said he was handing over the big golden trophy and medal on behalf of football fans worldwide. This was the announcement he made yesterday.
Mr. President, this is your prize, this is your peace prize. There is also a beautiful medal for you that you can wear everywhere you want to go.
I'm going to wear it right now.
Okay, let me hold. Fantastic. Excellent.
There we are. And Mr. Trump, as you can imagine, was rather pleased.
Most importantly, I just want to thank everybody. The world is a safer place now. The United States 1 year ago was not doing too well. And now I have to say we're the hottest country anywhere in the world, and we're going to keep it that way. Thank you all. Thank you. Have a great time. And Johnny, a tremendous honor. Thank you.
So what's this FIFA Peace Prize all about? I've been speaking to our football correspondent, John Murray, who's in Washington. I asked him, first of all, about the atmosphere in the room when the award was given.
It was not shock, because it was probably the worst-kept secret in Washington, possibly the worst-kept secret in the Western world, that Donald Trump was going to receive this award. And there is this love-in that has existed for quite a period of time between the FIFA president, Gianni Infantino, and Donald Trump, and this was probably it at its peak.
Yeah, I mean, presumably this is a new thing, right? It's a way of pleasing Mr. Trump.
I think certainly you could look at it in that way. I know that FIFA intend that this is something that it is presented and given out every year, but, you know, they are so close. We've seen them together at so many different events that it was, I think, an inevitability that this would come. And, you know, it's widely said and widely believed, isn't it, that Donald Trump's intention was to get the Nobel Peace Prize. And when that was not the case this year, then this has come along in its stead.
Yeah, and when you talk to other FIFA delegates, you know, senior people from FIFA, is there any sort of dissension within the ranks about all this?
FIFA is an extremely successful and efficient money-making operation. You know, in the time that he's been there, Gianni Infantino, you know, I've seen him, you know, in inverted commas, cozy up to Vladimir Putin. Now we have the United States, and the World Cup after next is already handed to Saudi Arabia. He is very adept, Gianni Infantino, at being able to get along with whoever is at the head of whichever country the World Cup is awarded to.
Sure, but what about within the ranks? Are there people saying they don't like it?
You know, anyone who is involved in FIFA will recognise the fact that, you know, the money-making that there is, you know, this is, as he said, next year's World Cup is one of the biggest events that has ever existed in the history of mankind. What that means is that it is an incredible money-making operation, which means that the FIFA financially is in a rude health, and this money filters down to all of the different federations around the world. So because it is successful in those terms, in a way, it strengthens the position of Gianni Infantino.
And what about the draw itself? What's the highlight fixture that's come out of the draw?
Well, after the torturous process and all of the razzmatazz and the long drawn out process that we saw to eventually get to this point, we do now have 12 groups that when you look at them, there are some fixtures and some matches. And for example, France, Senegal, Norway being in the same group, that promises to be extremely competitive. And as we know from history, when it comes to the World Cup, teams disappoint, teams overperform, and there are always surprises. But I think there's certainly enough there in what will be the biggest World Cup to keep football fans interested during the course of the 104 matches that will make up the tournament next summer.
And that was John Murray, our football correspondent in Washington. We've got Jacqueline Magne, part of our panel, and Emed Badi, who's from Libya. I don't think we were talking about it. I don't think they've made the World Cup finals yet, but not anyway. Well, one day. But what do you make of the fact that, because you're also from Canada, and, you know, you can forget with all this that this is a jointly held World Cup, Canada, Mexico, and the United States, and not just in America. You know, why didn't Mark Carney get the Peace Prize?
Well, I would suspect that probably some egos are at play here relative to how FIFA is going about it and playing politics as well, stroking Trump's ego, let's say. And also, I would say living in Toronto, soccer, as they call it, there's not the most popular sport. I think probably half of Canada will be a bit surprised by the size of the field.
Well, when it hits town, people will think, oh, goodness, football's this big.
I mean, it is technically hitting time. This is happening very, very soon.
Yeah.
So you'd expect preparations, but we're not seeing much actually on the ground.
Oh, really? There's not much sort of chat about it?
Not significantly, no.
And Jacqueline, the thing about Australia is they play everything brilliantly. You know, I'm watching the cricket now, which is England, Australia is on, and it's absolutely disastrous. So what's the attitude in Australia to the World Cup?
Well, we love it. But of course, in Australia, we have Australian rules, rugby league and rugby union as well. So
and the cricket.
There is always competing pressures for young men into what sport they want to play. So Australia will embrace it. And having been to a World Cup, I did covered it in Russia. It's the most incredible scene where you have tens of thousands of supporters of each team arrive. So it's like these mini villages of every nation that's there, and 48 nations will be competing. The logistics of this particular one across three countries is extraordinary. And it's going, if you think you're any businessman thinking they're going to be able to jump on a flight and do their normal business in America, Mexico and Canada next summer, think again. You will not be able to get a seat on a plane. But that presentation overnight, the draw, was incredible because Donald Trump was there wearing his medal, dancing to the village people, and Gianni Infantino also arranged for, you know, Bocelli to sing Nessun Dorma. It was bigger than Ben-Hur.
Thank you very much. More from you both later. You're listening to The World Service of the BBC. In November 2024, a ceasefire between Israel and Lebanon was supposed to bring hostilities between the two countries to a close, but since then there have been continued Israeli strikes on what it says are Hezbollah targets. Despite that, or perhaps because of it, civilian representatives from Israel and Lebanon have met under US mediation, and that's the first time there's been official contact like that for four decades. Well, on Friday, just after a visit of the UN Security Council to Lebanon, I spoke to Michel de Chada Evian. He's a diplomatic advisor to the Lebanese president. What are and why are Israel and Lebanon talking now?
Because the situation changed, we want to reach an agreement in order to liberate our occupied territories, to bring back our prisoners. And by the way, talking about prisoners, there are seven or eight prisoners captured during the war, and the remaining eight or nine other prisoners, they were captured after the agreement of ceasefire, because they went to see what happened with their houses, and they were kept by the Israeli forces. And we have also to trace our remaining borders with the Israeli. That's why it's now that we have to talk with them in order to solve these three points, three problems.
And are you confident that the U.S. mediation in this is neutral and is taking your views into account?
This is a difficult question to answer, but yes, as we consider the United States as a friend to Lebanon, and they want to play the role of a honest broker, we are confident that they will reach an agreement and they will be fair with Lebanon and with the other side.
As you look at the overall picture, the fact is Lebanon remains a weak state, doesn't it? And a lot of what you're talking about really reflects that. You're in no position to be responding to Israeli strikes on Lebanese territory. I mean, you're just weak.
Tell me, which country is not weak in front of Israel? If you know one country, tell me which one. They have the supremacy, military supremacy. And they can destroy Lebanon in 24 hours. They can destroy not only Lebanon, but the whole region. But what Israel will gain after all, I don't know. They made the war against Hamas in Gaza. They killed maybe 80,000. And they killed how many Hamas people? Hamas, purely Hamas people. And Hamas is still existing. So there is no at all any solution with the war. So we have to talk and we have to find to reach a solution.
And when you look at what's actually happening in the talks, I mean, can you say that the Lebanese and Israeli negotiators are, you know, approaching solutions or not really?
You know, yesterday is the first day where we have when we had the talks, including the two civilians, as you can called, one from the Lebanese side and the other from the Israeli side. We have to wait. This is the first meeting, and we have to wait to see what kind of solution we can reach. The important thing, we are not going to make a peace solution or peace agreement. Now what we are talking and what we are negotiating is about the occupied land, about the prisoners, and about the rest of the borders. This is what the goal of the meetings now. After, we don't know.
And that was Michel de Chateaurevian, diplomatic advisor to the Lebanese President Aoun. Now you're listening to the World Service of the BBC. And a couple of headlines. Rights groups have criticised the award by football's governing body of a new peace prize to President Trump at the draw for the Men's World Cup in Washington. And officials in Afghanistan say four civilians have been killed after an exchange of heavy fire with Pakistan's forces along their shared border. Right from the start, President Trump made immigration a key issue of his political platform. But even so, his comments on America's Somali community have been unusually direct. He said Somalis should go back to where they came from. Somalia is barely a country. They just run around killing each other. Figures show that as of 2024, there were 260,000 people of Somali descent living in America. And I've been speaking to one of them, Abdi Noor Iftin. He has written a book about his journey from Somalia as a Somali refugee to an American citizen called Call Me American. He told me how his fascination with the U.S. started as a child.
1992, I was just 7 when the U.S. Marines were parading in the streets of Mogadishu, and I couldn't speak a word of English. I remember using hand gestures to ask for candies, you know, and sweets and stuff that they brought from the U.S. And then from there, there was a local woman who was running a generator movie, a very small number selection of movies, including The Commando and The Terminator and Van Damme and, you know, Sylvester Stallone. And I grew up watching those action films until my friends nicknamed me American, mostly because I was imitating the action heroes. And I grew up thinking that it's a place that I would love, you know, to go and be part of that society that just seemed to be enjoying some sort of a freedom. And it's not quite true, honestly. Being in the U.S., there's a lot of problems. For example, I never thought that I would be seen as a black man, right? I mean, nobody ever called me a black man in Kenya or in Somalia. But in the U.S., you know, I was immediately thrown into a box that I didn't grow up with, and I had no history connected to that. And so it was, to me, that was quite an interesting thing that I've learned moving into the United States.
Mm. How did you get to America from Somalia?
I left Somalia in the year 2011. There was a brutal war going on at the time between Al-Shabaab, which was within the city. So I left and made my way to Kenya and joined 500,000 other refugees. And next thing I did was just show up at the United Nations High Commission for Refugees to register as a refugee. And that took me about 8 months to finally get my refugee papers. And so I've lived in Kenya for about 5 years. And I have tried everything. And eventually I was able to win the visa lottery program. And within 7 months, I was able to fly into the United States.
Yeah, it's an amazing program where you literally get your name drawn out of a hat, and if you're lucky enough to win, you get to live in America. So you've heard what President Trump said about American Somalis. What do you think of what he said?
It's a shock. In fact, I see it as a betrayal to the American dream, to my community, and I don't think he knows a lot of the contributions that my community is making to the United States, and especially specific words that the president has used. It's unacceptable, calling an entire community garbage and wanting all of us out. You know, it makes me feel betrayed.
Maybe you agree with some of what he said. I mean, he said that Somalia is a terrible place and that people just go around killing each other for no reason. And really, that's, I guess, why you fled.
Well, correct, but I don't agree with the narrative that people are just running around killing each other. If you look at its statistics, it's just a very small group.
I guess his point is that, you know, 500,000 people you said fled Somalia, it has been catastrophically badly run. So he's saying that that's the problem and that all the people who want, you know, the people like yourself should be contributing to Somalia and making it better.
Yeah, but how does that work? He's saying go back to the violence. I mean, come on. What happened to humanity? What happened to accepting people based on persecution, war, and all of that? You know, predominantly Somalis are in the U.S. and everywhere else because of their stories of war and persecution. So it's hate towards the Somalis.
You have full citizenship now, I'm thinking. So, you presumably don't feel very vulnerable, but many members of your community probably do if their papers aren't as far advanced as yours.
Correct. I'm a citizen now, and I have voted in the American presidential elections. But deep down, I'm actually scared, because if the president is targeting the community, whether we have legal documents or not, that just shows you that I can never be full American.
So you wrote a book called Call Me American, but actually you're saying you don't really feel as American as you did last week, probably.
Well, correct. If the president sees me as a Somali one way or another, it makes me feel, you know, kind of unwelcome, unaccepted, right? Whereas obviously these are not issues that I could be facing in Somalia, which is my native country. But also at the same time, there was a lot of sympathy and love. There is more America than Trump.
And did you say you have family in Somalia?
I do. Everybody, my mother, my sister, my father, and yeah, so they're all there.
I mean, do you ever think you will go back to be with them? I mean, you must miss them. They must miss you.
I do. It's been 13 years now since I saw my own mother. So I'm actually looking forward to the day I can go back, not, you know, completely moved there. I love being here, and I love the life that I have right now. And someday I would love to go back and see my family back in Somalia.
I must just put one final point to you. I mean, you said quite strongly you rejected Trump's language about people running around killing each other. And obviously that's a very emotive way of expressing himself. But a number of times in this interview, you have said you don't want to go back because it's too violent.
Well, it's quite true. I mean, let me say this. There are certain areas in the United States that I don't want to go to, you know, crime, gunshots, violence, and all of that. It does exist pretty much everywhere else. And Mogadishu, which is where my family is, I think it's still more dangerous than where I am right now, which is very peaceful. And if I have to go back to Somalia as someone who's put himself out there, you never know who's up looking for me. I haven't received any threats yet, but my mother says, well, if you have to come back, you have to watch your back, and that is not something I want to do.
And that was the Somali-American author Abdi Noor Iftin. I got my panel with us, Jacqueline Magnay, Europe correspondent of the Australian newspaper, and Ahmed Badi, senior fellow at the Global Initiative Against Transnational Organized Crime and a citizen of Canada, having been born in Libya. So you've got some experience of what the Somalis are going through. And I think it's something we don't often talk about, but the attitude to immigration in Canada is so very different to the attitudes that are now existing in the United States, isn't it? I mean, is there a parallel anti-immigration movement in Canada, and what scale compared to the US?
There is, but I would say this comes down to almost the underlying philosophy around migration, basically, and also the institutional frameworks between Canada and the US. So Canada's a lot more reliant on a sort of points-based, merit-based system. So there's more predictability for Somalis or any other nationality, really, in terms of integration. And also, it's a lot less influenced by the type of presidency that we have. So we haven't seen, I mean, yes, it would probably differ between liberal and conservative a little bit, but it's not to the extent that you would have a president outright othering a community. I think this would be deemed probably very unacceptable in Canada because of the way political culture and identity is formative to political debates.
And Jacqueline, you know, we've got President Trump making these, you know, quite provocative remarks, but in a way, it's just all part of winding people up, trolling, as they call it, the attention economy.
Yes, I can see elements of that, certainly. He was very aggressive in his language, though, and I can see why Somali people are quite concerned. But Abdi made an interesting point there about promoting Somali contribution to America, that perhaps they need to be a little bit more proactive in showing this is what we are giving you. It's not just a one-way street. And I think that many migrants feel that it's all about the messaging, isn't it? And showing that they are contributing to American society.
Well, President Trump just says they're always complaining.
Well, that's what he said yesterday. What does he say today? I mean, it's up and down, isn't it? But, you know, it's one of those, you know, I come from Australia, which has the strictest border controls in the world.
You're the points-based system king.
Well, we are, and like Canada, it's supposedly very regulated and controlled, and you have to satisfy certain requirements in a measured and ordered way to come into the country rather than through boat and asylum seekers. So elections are won and lost in Australia on this very issue. So it's number one in people's consciousness. And so Australians find it very difficult to understand the migration issue in countries, especially in the UK and Europe with the migrant crisis, to get a handle on it. And they say, why aren't they being stronger? I think many Australians would perhaps think, well, Donald Trump's got a point here.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much, both of you, Jacqueline Magnay and Ahmed Badi. More from you later. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is Owen Bennett-Jones with Weekend.
Distribution of the BBC World Service in the U.S. is made possible by American Public Media. APM produces and distributes award-winning public radio programs that inform, engage, and captivate. APM is proud to connect audiences to the world with accurate, impartial, international news and global perspectives from the BBC World Service.
Support for KQED comes from European Sleepworks, the store that bases its design and materials on research factors affecting sleep, including comfort and support, humidity levels, and ease of breathing. Details online about their mattresses and bedding at sleepworks.com. And this week at KQED.org, Bay Area electricity bills are some of the highest, but where does that money go? Reporter Laura Clivens breaks down the charges on one bill. That's at KQED.org.
Still to come on the program, we'll be hearing from a boss of a Sri Lankan tea business. He'll be talking about the impact of the floods in Sri Lanka and how come a kayak is heading from the Vatican to Canada and rare metals at great depths in the seas. That's all coming up on Weekend with Owen Bennett-Jones.
BBC News with Eileen McHugh. Rights groups have criticised the award by football's governing body of a new peace prize to President Trump at the draw for the Men's World Cup in Washington. The American Civil Liberties Union said that by handing out the award, FIFA risked becoming a stage for authoritarianism. The Colombian government has signed an agreement with the country's largest armed group aimed at bringing its eventual disarmament and a lasting peace. The Clan del Golfo is a major drug trafficking gang. Officials in Afghanistan say four civilians have been killed after an exchange of heavy fire with Pakistan's forces along their shared border. Three injuries were reported in Pakistan. Sporadic fighting has repeatedly broken out between the two countries in recent months. Thousands of far-right demonstrators have gathered in the South Korean capital Seoul in support of the impeached president Yoon Suk-yeol. It comes just over a year after he declared martial law. Our correspondent at the protest says they highlight the growing polarization in South Korean society. US lawmakers have expressed concern about Netflix's proposed takeover of Warner Brothers' streaming and studio business worth $72 billion. Critics say it would leave Americans with higher streaming costs and fewer options. The president of Sri Lanka has announced financial help for people whose houses were destroyed by Cyclone Ditwa last week. Thousands of survivors who lost their homes will receive payments to buy land away from high-risk flood zones and build new housing. And several hospitals in Britain have started a trial of a new technique to treat prostate cancer. Known as aquablation, the surgery involves a robotic-assisted high-pressure water jet to remove cancerous tissue while avoiding surrounding nerves and muscles. Currently, the main treatment involves removing the entire prostate gland. BBC News.
You're listening to Weekend from the BBC World Service with Owen Bennett-Jones. And coming up in the next 30 minutes, the Vatican and Canada, some deep-sea mining, and, of course, our panellists with me in the studio for the rest of the programme, Jacqueline Magnay, Europe correspondent for the Australian newspaper, and Emmett Baddy, senior fellow at the Global Initiative Against Transnational Organised Crime. They'll be helping interpret and explain what's been going on in the news as we go through the programme. And I'll ask them now to listen to a discussion on Sri Lanka. It is still trying to cope with the devastating floods after Cyclone Ditwa swept through large parts of the country in November. Hundreds of people still missing, 25,000 houses damaged or destroyed. And it's reckoned they'll need $7 billion to reconstruct, presumably. Much of it they will try and seek abroad. So the needs are overwhelming. This woman is just one example, displaced from her home. We suffer like this every time, she says. No place to stay. Our houses and everything have been destroyed, need to be rebuilt. We'll have to start from the beginning. Well, the president of Sri Lanka has announced financial help for people whose houses were destroyed like that. Thousands of survivors are going to get $30,000. And the hope is they'll buy land away from high-risk flood zones and
build something new. Dilhan Fernando is the Chief Executive Officer of Dilma Tea and also Chairman of the UN Global Compact in Sri Lanka. So we all know about Dilma Tea, which gets drunk all over the place. And you're a business, taking a business perspective to this. How impressed or not impressed are you by the relief operation so far?
Well, Owen, the situation was cataclysmic. We had 10% of our annual rainfall in just 24 hours, and that too on already saturated soil. So I don't think there is any form of preparation that could have readied us for this. But nevertheless, the preparation was weak in terms of planning and being mindful of the fact that we are emerging from a triple whammy of COVID, Easter bombings and the economic crisis in Sri Lanka. I think planning was weak. In terms of the response, the international community has been fantastic. And I'm, your newsreader just mentioned the president's reaction. I think right now we have 1.5 million people who are either displaced or directly affected, lost their homes. And it's incredibly reassuring. But what is particularly beautiful going through the streets and going up in the plantation districts is to see Sri Lankans helping each other regardless of ethnicity or faith or whichever. And that's a positive side, but I guess the weakness, the negative side, is that it has exposed a vulnerability which began with 30 years of conflict and continued through this last three incidents that we simply weren't prepared.
I mean, I think it's fair to say there's never a natural disaster when everyone says, oh, the response was brilliantly planned. I mean, it's, yeah, it is very difficult, I mean, for governments to do this, isn't it? Because there are so many potential threats around the corner, and it is hard to prepare properly for all of them.
Particularly when you're financially weakened, though, and I think in our situation, we are grappling with so many other matters. We've been focused on what was said to be our best ever tourist season, which indicated, that's a significant indicator of economic recovery for Sri Lanka. And of course, we were preparing for that. There was a lot of infrastructural work that was being done in preparation. The government is addressing corruption. They're relatively new, and so therefore also trying to get to grips with the demands of this current IMF terms. And I guess, absolutely, there was nothing that could have prepared us for the scale of this ferocity. You know.
And what about your business, the tea business? Obviously, that would be very vulnerable, you'd think, to flooding. What happened?
It is. Well, landslides happened. We lost people, I mean, on our tea gardens, a legacy of the past. I guess we have not only our own workers, we have communities living on the tea gardens, and we need to take care of them. So we lost many of them because of the terrain and the fact that the soil was already saturated. And so it shifted boulders when you had an estimated 150,000 cubic meters per second of water blasting through this country. You can imagine the consequences. But I think what was significant is the breadth of this disaster. It covered agriculture, it covered tourism, it just of the 25 districts, 22 were affected.
I don't know how tea works. I mean, presumably, if you lose a tea plant, it takes some years to get another one, you know, of a similar maturity.
It does. It wasn't so much the tea plants. I think the tea plants were reasonably resilient, and that's really not our concern, rather not our priority at this stage. It's the people connected to because tea, like most agricultural industries, it's about the people, and we're a social enterprise, so that remains our preoccupation.
Okay, so just as you look ahead to the next, let's say, 6 months, what are you hoping can be achieved with the funds that you are receiving?
Well, I think that it has highlighted the urgency of climate adaptation. And this is something that was talked about but never really implemented at a national level. It's not only the government, of course, it's the people, it's the businesses, etc. And so whilst it comes at a cost, what I'm hoping is that while people will understand the importance of rebuilding and getting their lives together, that we will rebuild, as you mentioned a moment ago, in a climate resilient way, protecting riverbanks, ensuring that urban planning is better to allow for the wetlands and drainage and floodplains and so on.
Yeah, basically, don't build where it's going to flood.
Absolutely, and the science has been telling us ever since Nicholas Stern's report in 2005 that there are certain things that we should do to adapt, and it's a lot easier and lot less costly to adapt and to prepare than to confront the challenge of global warming.
You do have a very long memory. That was a report. It was a huge report at the time, but I haven't heard that mentioned for many, many years. That's the Stern report, yeah. Dilhan Fernando, Chief Executive of Dilma T. Thank you very much. I should say he's also got a UN connection, Chairman of the UN Global Compact in Sri Lanka. You're listening to Weekend from the World Service of the BBC. The Vatican may be a tiny country, but I think it's fair to say it has some big secrets. Just think back to the information it held about the Nazis fleeing from Germany to South America after the Second World War, the so-called rat lines. And who would have thought that for the last 100 years it has held dozens of cultural artefacts belonging to indigenous communities across Canada? Those objects are now going back home, arriving today in Montreal, a repatriation agreed in 2023, shortly after Pope Francis went to Canada and apologised for the role of the Catholic Church in the residential school system after years of pressure from Canada's indigenous communities. Here is some of that apology.
Pido perdón.
Sorry for the ways in which, regrettably, many Christians supported the colonizing mentality of the powers that oppress the indigenous peoples. I am sorry. I ask forgiveness.
Well, Assistant Professor Cody Grote specializes in indigenous cultural heritage and repatriation at Western University. He is a Mohawk citizen, a member of the Six Nations of the Grand River Reserve in southwestern Ontario. So, first of all, what sort of items have been repatriated?
It's a bit of a difficult process because right now we don't necessarily know what all is returning to Canada. Now, some ways that is a good thing because for a lot of Indigenous nations here in Canada, we have specific cultural practices about which items can and should be shown to a general public. Often there are cultural or spiritual values associated with our items. So in regards to this repatriation, we might not explicitly present a list of what is being returned until Indigenous nations and our elders or knowledge keepers have the chance to review these items to decide what all is going to be disclosed. So in some ways they're cultural and spiritual, in other ways they are quite practical items, like a kayak, for instance, that is being repatriated to Indigenous peoples in northern Canada.
And one of the complications of this is that, as I understand it, these items are being sent from the Vatican to the Catholic Church in Canada. It's a church-to-church thing. So does that mean you get full access to them when they arrive?
That's something that has been quite contested here because the Vatican is really clearly articulating that this is a church-to-church transfer. They don't want to establish a precedent whereby the Vatican is transferring these items directly to Indigenous peoples. And I think that's not just for a Canadian sake. I think they're recognizing that this repatriation might set the stage for broader international repatriation requests. So what's going to happen is the Canadian Conference of Catholic Bishops will temporarily house some of these items in the Canadian Museum of History, a federal crown corporation as we refer to it, and then the Canadian Museum of History will engage in some consultation with what we call our three national Indigenous organizations, and those national Indigenous organizations will then work with communities on the ground to determine which communities are the best caretakers or stewards for these items. So it's going to be quite a convoluted process.
Yeah. What do you make of the Vatican's point that a lot of these items were actually gifts? And there was gift giving, wasn't there, when Europeans turned up in North America? That did happen. So that must affect their legal status, really.
There is diplomatic histories of Indigenous nations using gift-giving as a way to form diplomatic relationships. But when we look at the timing of when these items entered the Vatican's hands, this was 1925 in the context of an exhibit to support or touch on the strength of missionary endeavors. Now, at this time in Canadian history, we had something called the Indian Residential School System, a really culturally assimilative system run by Christian denominations and the government of Canada to assimilate Indigenous peoples into Western society. Now, Pope Francis recognized this system as being genocidal in his own words, which was quite a significant international revelation. We also know that in 1925, we had legislation called the Indian Act, which is still in effect, but at the time, the Indian Act declared cultural practices illegal. So yes, there is a history of diplomatic gift giving, but I think it is appropriate to contest that language in regards to these items, noting the time in which these items entered the Vatican hands. I think it is questionable as to the legal status of these items.
You're mentioning those schools just prompted me to wonder, you know, there was an attempt, as you say, to convert people in these schools to Christianity.
Yes.
Did that work? I mean, is there a substantial Christian First Nation population in Canada?
I would say it does exist. There is a presence. My grandparents attended the Indian residential school system as well. And again, they experienced this cultural assimilation, which was often paired with systemic abuse and violence and malnutrition. We notice that these two things happen simultaneously. There is a population of Indigenous peoples who are Catholics and who are Christians, but I think we can recognize two things at the same time. We can recognize this population that did, you know, embrace Christianity while also recognizing the significant damage that structures such as Christianity did have on Indigenous people simultaneously. I think Pope Francis did a good job acknowledging those two things, and I think it'll be interesting to see how Pope Leo navigates that, especially being a pope from North America.
And looking ahead, you've mentioned that there'll be a sort of a stage where these end up in a museum. But what's your hope for the final destination of these objects?
My hope is that we can recognize that there are multiple ways in which cultural items can be preserved that reflect different worldviews. So from a very Western perspective, we look to museums, we look to institutions to preserve these in climate-controlled vaults on display. I think from the perspective of many Indigenous peoples here in what is now Canada, we recognize these items have a role to play in community. They can be handled by elders and knowledge keepers to help convey and pass down knowledge over time. These items might break down. They might not be in the same condition as they were when they were in the Vatican's hands, but I don't think we can recognize that as lesser, or I don't think we should recognize that as lesser. I think we can recognize that cultural items in community that break down over time have still played a very vital and important role, and that's also fine.
And that was Professor Cody Grote, who is a specialist in Indigenous cultural heritage and repatriation at Western University in Canada. Our panel's still with us. Emmett Baddy, Senior Fellow at the Global Initiative Against Transnational Organized Crime, and Jacqueline Magnay, Europe Correspondent for The Australian, which has been, Australia's been grappling with these issues too. But Emmett Baddy, you've been living in Canada for 5 years, did you say? What surprised you about the Indigenous people's issue when you got there? I don't know how familiar you were with it before. What did you make of it?
Well, as a Canadian, well, I would say immigrant, but now citizen, I'm sort of continually learning about the relationship of the country to First Nations and to Indigenous people. The more I learn about the residential school system that was described in the interview, the more striking it was, actually, how brutal, how genocidal it was, really. And I don't say that lightly. And it's ironic almost to contrast that with the sort of usual reputation that Canada has, or has they been able to nurture internationally. And you clearly see that events like these sort of cut through that. Luckily, it's now more and more openly acknowledged, both this history, its implications, the need to also have dialogues. And this is still very much a present issue, because Canada is a young country. The man was, the professor was talking about his grandparents, so this second, third generation.
As someone who's come from Libya, which had its own colonial experience, do you see, you know, and what happened to Indigenous people is colonial, often described as colonialism. Do you see parallels between what happened to the Libyans and what happened to the Indigenous in Canada?
Definitely. I mean, the residential school system was very similar in a way to a similar, really, indoctrination system that was in eastern Libya that is now openly, I want to say, acknowledged historically, at least by scholars, as genocidal in very much the same way we experienced Italian colonialism. So it's different flavors, let's say, but pretty much the same recipe.
Jacqueline Magne, in Australia, I think similar, not from the Vatican, but similar repatriations of cultural objects have been happening.
Oh, this has been going on for a decade, and we've had not only objects. This year we had the Gweagle spears, which were the first spears that Captain Cook took off the Aboriginal people back in 1770 when, you know, he landed at Botany Bay. But we've had 36 remains returned this year, over 1,700 artefacts.
When you say remains, what do you mean?
We're talking about ancestral bones. And when I arrived in London, you know, 15 years ago, I went down to the Royal Pavilion in Brighton, and I was shocked that there on display was an Aboriginal skull. It was being used as a water vessel. Not at the time, it had previously been used as a water vessel. That particular skull has since been returned to this South Australian Indigenous communities. But for Australians, this is something where we're getting objects from many museums in the UK, France, across Europe. Of course, these were sometimes gifts, loans, but some of these objects were also purchased, and some were also raided from graves back in Australia and brought back for, you know, medical purposes to investigate their skulls.
And so that's something you'll be writing about for The Australian, is it? I mean, yes. When you pitch an article on the repatriation of objects to your editors, they're like, yeah, we'll have that.
Well, yes, of course they want it, but it's also a story that we know we are very familiar with, and it's not unusual. It's something that happens on a regular basis.
Okay, well, that's interesting to hear that. Thank you very much to Jacqueline Magne and Emma Baddy. We'll be coming back to you in a moment. You're listening to the World Service of the BBC. This is Owen Bennett-Jones with Weekend. Now, we've got Roland Pease back with us on Weekend. He's doing a bit of science for us. And this week, we're focusing on the deeper seas, Roland, because concerns have been expressed that plans to recover valuable metals from the very deep ocean could have serious consequences for rather fragile creatures that live on the ocean floor. What can you tell us about that?
Well, this is all a long-term plan people have had to extract these things called manganese nodules, which are sort of potato-sized lumps of metal that have collected on the very deep ocean floor of the Pacific. And they contain important... Sorry.
All right, there.
Sorry about that.
Sounds like you're down under the ocean yourself. Yeah.
I'm busy. I'm popular. They contain important metals that are needed for the energy transition. Metals like manganese and cobalt and nickel, which are used in batteries, for example, in great demand. And these lumps have been accumulating at the bottom of the sea, just precipitating but chemically out of the seawater for millions of years. And they're just sitting there. So the idea is you can go and pick these things up and haul them back to land and process them, and it's a different way from mining on land, which has sort of, it sort of sounds very attractive, but the only problem is that as people have been exploring these areas, they found that these incredibly deep, 5 kilometer deep sort of flat plains, which look almost like moonscapes in a way, so you imagine them to be very hostile. There's no light down there, it's cold. You'd expect it to be lifeless, but for a long time, scientists have realised that actually there's quite a lot going on there. As the National Oceanographic Centre's Tammy Horton told me, if you go down there, look at a video, the initial impressions you might get can be really misleading.
It looks like a bit of a desert, you know, mud interspersed with these potato-sized manganese nodules, which is what the deep sea mining is aiming for. But the interesting thing is what we're not seeing, the incredible diversity of life, which is sitting inside the mud. And that's what our research is about. It's looking at those tiny little animals. There's not huge numbers of them, but what is there is very, very diverse and largely unknown.
I mean, would any of them be beautiful? I mean, do you have to be a biologist?
Yes. Oh, they're stunning. They are absolutely gorgeous. So when we're looking at the video footage, you'll see this vast desert, and interspersed there'll be larger animals. So there are larger animals, these sponges on stalks, anemones, beautiful anemones, sea cucumbers, roaming the seabed, brittle stars, these starfish, crustaceans. So there is a lot of life, but the larger animals are few and far between. But when you look in a little bit more detail and you see the tiny animals that are living inside the mud, it's amazing. They are absolutely stunning. There are so many different types and forms, absolutely stunning. And all of it's new to science. So it's amazing.
Well, Roland Pease, I guess it's, yeah, this is something that happens on Earth as well as in the deep sea. It's the trade-off between the environment and mining operations.
Absolutely, but the thing is that until now, they didn't really know how serious this could be, but 3 years ago, 2022, a company called the Metals Company were sent in a sort of enormous tractor down onto the seabed, sucked about 3,000 tons of these metal nodules up into the tracks. And this was the first chance that ecologists had got to look at what the ecology was like beforehand and then afterhand and see the difference. And indeed, they did find that there were really quite serious direct effects.
We did see big changes, a reduction in densities of these smaller animals of more than a third, 37% decrease in the path of the nodule collector, so the big tractor-like machine that's going to collect the samples. We were able to sample directly inside that path, and we saw a decrease by 37%, and also a decrease in the diversity of those animals in that track.
And you talk about the sediments which a lot of these creatures are living in. My impression is that these have been built up over thousands, if not millions of years, very slowly, with grain sort of snowing down onto the seabed.
Yes.
I presume that this operation would be a bit like not just clearing the trees from the Amazon, but also taking away all the soil and leaving bare rocks.
Exactly that,
so
yeah.
So what's the prospect for recovery?
Well, the prospect for recovery we don't know very much about. We only know what we've already seen, and that is in other studies over 44 years, that the recovery in that sedimented area, there's still impact where sediment has been removed. It doesn't go back to normal sediment type. So absolutely it does completely remove that top layer of soil, as you would call it. And of course it's also removed the nodules, the actual potato-sized mineral that they're targeting. And that is also a substrate for the animals that live there. So there are some animals that are only found on those nodules.
Like on a high rise.
Yes. So if you remove those little animals found only on the nodules will never come back. Once they're gone, they're gone.
Tammy Horton there speaking with Roland Pease, and still with me our panel, Jacqueline Magne and Emmett Baddy. Did either of you study a philosophy course at university?
Philosophy?
No.
Okay,
well, I'm still going to give you
biology.
Biology, okay. Yeah, that's going to help a bit. But I'm going to put a, you know, moral philosophical dilemma to you. What's more important, the human benefit of all these mining operations, which sounds very important for our technologies and all the rest of it and will bring benefits to humans, or these animals no one's ever heard about?
Well, we don't know what these animals contribute to the cycle, do we, of the food chain. And they could be the very, very beginnings of something else that eats them that then has an impact.
Yeah.
And so we don't know the impact. All we know is that they were destroying their environment. And we need to be very careful about that.
About humans or deep sea creatures?
It comes down to that choice. I would tend to agree with Jacqueline on this. We don't exactly know, so I think we shouldn't be tampering probably with something we know little about.
Roland Pease, are you going to make it 3-0 on this?
I was listening to your item on the flooding in Sri Lanka just a little bit earlier, and the trouble is with the global warming that's going on, we're damaging the planet in other ways as well at the same time. And if this is way out, I mean, that's the big dilemma, isn't it? That can you do this with as minimal impact as possible? In other words, can you have your cake and eat it, really, in science terms?
Roland doesn't give an answer, but are you going to give one?
No, well, I was just going to say, that was quite political. That was dodging the trade-off, which is what politicians always do, isn't it? If they've got, you know, two difficult choices, that decision is always...
I did ask Tammy the same question, and she did the same thing. She said, we'll provide you... I mean, the problem is, at the moment, they know so little about the life cycles of these creatures or anything. So it's so unknown, Jacqueline was saying.
Yeah.
We don't know the answers.
Yeah, so there is a jeopardy there. Well, Jacqueline, I, as a BBC presenter, never give an opinion on anything, so I trust that you've not been able to work out what I think about this. And that is what we've got for this hour. Jacqueline Magne, thanks very much. Thanks, Roland Pease and Emmett Baddy. You're listening to the World Service of the BBC.
Support for KQED comes from European Sleepworks, a store that bases its design and materials on research factors affecting sleep, including comfort and support, humidity levels, and ease of breathing. Details online about their mattresses and bedding at sleepworks.com.
Tobias Gesso Jr. has written perfect pop songs for other artists like Adele and Justin Bieber, but when it comes to his own music, he embraces the imperfections.
It was the first song I finished recording. Then I turned around and looked, I'm like, bah! Like, I didn't turn on the mic, it's just like flatlined, you know?
Tobias Gesso Jr. on his new album, Shine, Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News. Here's a jackrabbit.
Weekend Edition starts at 5 a.m. here on member-supported KQED, 88.5 San Francisco and KQEI.